Tonight, as we approach the last weekend of Frank Stella, a retrospective, we are fortunate to begin this fall season of Tuesday evening with a Stella scholar of a very specific sort. Dr. Robert K. Wallace, who wrote Frank Stella's Moby Dick, Words and Shapes, is here to help bid farewell to one of this museum's most beloved exhibitions as he shares highlights from his physical as well as intellectual journey as he tried to follow and then interpret Stella's 12-year pursuit of Melville's epic novel, Moby Dick. I think many of you are familiar with those works that are located in Gallery 3, so it'll be nice to get these insights. Dr. Wallace is Regents Professor of English at Northern Kentucky University, where he has taught since 1972. He is a specialist in literature and the arts. His publications include Jane Austen and Mozart, 1983, Emily Bronte and Beethoven from 1986, Melville and Turner from 1992. I think you see a pattern. And as mentioned, Frank Stella's Moby Dick in 2000. Also Douglas and Melville in 2005, and Hagee and Shear's Moby Dick in 2013. He is currently writing a book on Frederick Douglass and Cincinnati anti-slavery. In addition to writing, he has curated exhibitions throughout the U.S. Most recently, he co-curated a two-person exhibition at the Contemporary Arts Center in Cincinnati and an exhibition featuring the work of eight women at the Marta Hewitt Gallery this past spring. Both exhibitions were based on works pertaining to Moby Dick and resulted in a blog titled Moby Dick in Cincinnati in 2016, which is where I encountered Dr. Wallace, his infectious passion for his subject, and being a real sucker for anybody who loves what they do, I knew I wanted to extend an invitation for him to give this Tuesday evening lecture. As this brief introduction suggests, Dr. Wallace is a Melville scholar. He is a past president of Melville Society and a founder of Melville Society Cultural Project in New Bedford, Massachusetts. And it is his investment in Melville in conjunction with his enthusiasm for the work of Frank Stella that has brought him here tonight. So if you would, please join me in welcoming Dr. Frank Wallace.
Thank you very much, Terry. It's a real honor to be part of your Tuesday night series and to be able to speak about a very small slice of your amazing retrospective of Stella's career, which is a real curatorial achievement. I was very excited to see the show at the Whitney, and it's equally exciting to see it here. Very different installation in the two different buildings, and just an amazing opportunity to look at this man's career. Going all the way back to the 50s, and he's still very active today. So here we go. I don't know if any of you saw this in the New York Times not too long ago during the Olympics in Rio. This is a star that Stella just did a year ago, and the Rio Museum bought it just in time to be down there for the Olympics, and that's a Kenyan marathoner who's running by it. And I'm showing this image because it shows the relation of Stella's works to the human body. And when I went to the Whitney show to just walk through 60 years of his creativity, I was really struck by the spatial power, the way it relates to us as human beings in a physical way. And that's very true in your show here. This is a show of an image of the marathon that they had at the Whitney. And there, too, you can really see very nicely the relation of these big reliefs to the human body. And you've got the larger-than-life works, you've got the people, and connecting the works and the people in this case, that's the marathon that you're going to have here soon, which takes about 24 hours only to read through that very long novel out loud. So it's Melville's words that are connecting the human bodies with the artistic bodies in this case. But when you're not doing a marathon, it's our words as we speak to each other about our impressions about the work. And that's the important exchange. This is a quote from a later book by Melville, Fiction, and he's comparing it to religion, actually. Fiction should present another world, and yet one to which we feel the tie. And I think that's a beautiful model for Stella's entire career. Because of the abstraction, it's different. Because of the size, it's something apart from us, but there's a tie. And if fiction and art works well, that tie is what we want to understand and share with people. So I'm going to start with the first work by Frank Stella I ever saw, and it was in November of 89. I had never heard about Stella and had not taken courses in art history, but I had started thinking about Melville in relation to art, and I was starting to write a book about Melville and Turner, the British painter. And one of my colleagues thought maybe the people at the Midwest Art Association would like to hear a talk about that. So I gave a talk, and it was in Cincinnati, across the river from where I live. And I met a painter and a printmaker there. And they said, you know, we're going down to the Solway Gallery to see this show by Frank Stella and Yoko Ono. Do you want to come along? And I said, well, why not? Let's see what it is. So we walk in the door, and this is what we see. And they're just going wild about the technical finesse of this print. The juxtaposition of color, the fact that he's combining six different printing techniques seamlessly. And I say, well, you know, what is it about? What's it about? Does it have a title? So I look over on the wall and I say, this is The Whale is a Dish. That's a title in Moby Dick. And these were seven of his wave prints, part of the Moby Dick series that were having their premiere. This was the first month they were ever being shown. And so seven of them were there, seven prints and seven titles. This was right around the corner, and this is Moby Dick, a name for chapter 41. And that was pretty interesting because he's, you know, known as an abstract painter, especially at that time, but this wave looks a lot like a whale, right? It's very like a whale. And in fact, the head is very squarish, like the head of a sperm whale differs from all the other whales, as Melville tells us in the novel, because of its squarish shape. This individual whale has a little tight twist in the body to give it individuality, and it has flukes and fins. And it's a very distinctive shape that allows us to recognize it as it keeps coming back in the series, much like a character might in a novel. I had, not having taken an art history course, at this point in my life, I'd never heard the term negative space. But that I saw in the next print. And there's the absence of that whale shape right in the center of this print, and it happens to be named for Ahab's leg, where Ahab lost his leg to the whale and then devoted his life to trying to kill the whale itself. So more than accidental naming here, it's really nice. And the absence of the whale shape here allows you to really see the Chinese lattice shape, which is one of 13 lattice shapes that Stella used throughout the series, and they continue through the series just like his wave shapes do. Here is another wave shape in that first show that looks like a whale, not the whole body, but the head up there at the top with a mouth, and it's again, it's a squarish type head. Certainly if you're a Moby Dick guy like me, you see this as a whale's head. And it also has its negative shape in another print. And they're cut out of the same paper. He's very efficient. He's not wasting any paper. And I think, ironically, you can see the whale better in its absence here than you can in its presence in the previous print. So early in the series, he's introducing these images that are going to be the material of the series. Well, I was pretty turned on by this, and so I asked Carl Solway, is there any more of this Moby Dick stuff by this guy? And he says, well, he's an artist in New York, and he's done six more wave prints the year before, so there were 13. And he's starting to do metallic reliefs, named for Moby Dick. And if you want to learn about those, well, you should get in touch with Knoedler Gallery, his representative in New York. So I called up Knoedler, and they said, yes, He's doing quite a few metallic reliefs. And I said, well, do you think he'd answer a letter if I wrote to his studio in New York? And they said, well, we'll give you the address, but he probably won't answer you because he's very busy. So I wrote and didn't get an answer. I didn't really expect one. And they told me about four works that were in widely separated American cities if I wanted to start looking at the reliefs that were in public spaces. However, there were nine of them that were going to be in a public show in Japan, because most of the works that had been sold had gone either to Japan or Europe at this point. Well, nine works at one time sounded pretty good to me, so I started investigating making my first trip to Japan. And the show started at the Kawamura Museum in Sakura and ended in June of 91. I couldn't make that, but it moved on to Kitakyushu, just like Whitney Museum moved to Fort Worth, so I caught up with it there. I asked Nodler Gallery, if I tried to go when Stella went for the opening, do you think I could meet him there and talk to him about the series? And they said, he's going to be too busy, don't count on that, but I figured, why not go at that time? So I decided to go and see these works, because I really wanted to see what he would do with this kind of imagery. So this is the Sphinx, one of the shows there. And you can see the relation to the human body, because everyone there went in and stuck their head inside that eye-like hole in the Sphinx. The Sphinx happens to be the chapter in the novel where they have killed their first sperm whale. The head of the whale is hanging from the side of the ship. The rest of the body is being pulled up into the mast so they can start processing it. So here you've got the head of the whale that we've seen in the print before, and you've got a very tail-like shape up looming there above it. So he has positioned his chosen shapes and put them in relationship to each other with a very close parallel to what's going on in that particular chapter. He doesn't always do that, but he often does. This is Shark Massacre, and here's a closer look at where the action takes place, and that's a very violent chapter because the men are killing the sharks with spades, and the sharks are biting whatever's around, including their own tails sometimes, and it's blood-mudded water, and there's just death and hazard everywhere. And Stella here has two of the wave shapes that are being crunched and bloodied in this mechanism. It gives you that same sense of carnage that is in that chapter. There behind the people is a much more pleasant image, and this is Merry Christmas, and it's named for the chapter where the ship finally leaves land after 22 chapters. The novel finally gets going. And here you can see clearly, and from the show here too, how Stella is using shapes from earlier in his career. So right in the center is a protractor shape, and there's one of the cones from the Cones and Pillars shape, which was the one right before Moby Dick. So he keeps using imagery up in a series and then adding incrementally new kinds of image as he moves on. And here there's a wave right there. The golden wave is hidden under the protractor, but he's just introducing the wave to say, I'm launching a new kind of series here that's going to have a nautical tone to it as we go along. This was one of my favorites. It's called The Spirit Spout. And I stood in front of this, I felt that wave was crucified on that disc. It just felt that way. It made a very strong impression on me. And when I did get to meet Stella later and asked him about this work without sharing my impression, just to see what he had in mind, that was actually something similar. He was thinking of Rubens' Descent from the Cross. So he's taking these abstract images and making very provocative potentials for interpretation, and hopefully when they come through, they might be stronger than something that comes labeled with a kind of obvious meaning. I love this work. It's called The Pipe. And that's when Ahab's smoking a pipe and he throws it lighted into the sea because he can't enjoy life anymore, because unless he kills that whale, that's all he's living for. And I love this because, well, you can see the Moby Dick whale the Moby Dick whale shape that we saw in the print, and then there's the tail from the Sphinx. And he's put those two shapes together in a new kind of relationship. And he's just such a master at getting new expression out of forms we've seen before. And that's another way in which I feel these waves grow in relationship to each other the way characters do in a good story. This was the most surprising work. We're talking 1991, and he did this in 1990. It's called The Masthead. And this is the first relief that he did not paint. He had planned to paint it. It's made of three kinds of aluminum, fabricated aluminum and honeycombed aluminum and poured aluminum. He likes mixing medias and see what they can do. And once he did that, he liked the metallic mixture so beautifully, he wanted to leave it that way. So he left it that way. It's an unpainted metallic relief. And this was the absolute transition toward being a sculptor. He had not done any freestanding sculptures at this time, but he would be doing so soon in the Moby Dick series. So I had hoped to meet him, and I got to meet him in Kitakyushu, and he did was excited, kind of, or at least interested that somebody had come from Kentucky to see his work. And he granted me an interview the next morning, and I brought along a cassette tape recorder just in case and got a great interview with him. And he invited me to come to his studio when we were back in the States. And I got about 12 tape recorded interviews with him in the next 5 years as he continued working on the series. And I visited his studio in New York many times, and twice to Tyler Graphics, where they're making the prints, and twice to the Talix Foundry, where they're making the sculptures once he started doing that. So it was very interesting, obviously, to talk to him about the series. And I was really interested in those wave shapes because they're so different from his previous forms. He took the stripes, the polygons, pre-existing geometric forms like protractors, flexicurves, cones, but these were figurative shapes. These were with an obvious narrative potential, and he drew them. So on the top left, you can recognize the Moby Dick wave we've seen. Next to that is the other square-headed head of a whale. There's the spirit wave on the far right. And in the middle are two very prominent shapes here on the lower left, here in Fort Worth. What I call the two-headed wave on the left, because there's a large kind of monster head on the bottom and a kind of sweeter, I call it a seahorse head above it. There are different kinds of expression. And the one in the lower middle is the one you have in the blanket, which I call a three-way wave because the shape down toward the bottom looks like a human head and arms, which is very rare for Stella. He'd never done that before. And the bone-like structure to the right, that's if you know the structure of a whale, that's the skeletal structure of a whale's head. And then they combine to make a wave. So it's a very interesting image that flows through all of these, work through the series in various ways. I found out when I met him that because his son had challenged him, he decided to do one work for every chapter of the novel, 138 chapter headings. So you have five works here, which is tremendous. You never see five Moby Dick reliefs together at the same time, but that's five out of 138 in the series itself in terms of chapter titles. And these and all other metallic reliefs, almost all others, are done in multiple versions. So you have five out of 266 unique works in the series that he did over a 12-year period. So this is just the tip of the iceberg, or the head of the whale, when you've got the whole rest of the body underneath. So what I want to try to do is give a sense of the rest of the series too. And to get control of that myself, I made this kind of double matrix chart where the columns, the vertical columns from the left to the right, are the chapters of the novel. And then the columns coming down are the series, the various sub-series. He started with the S reliefs, a bunch of painted reliefs. Then there are the 13 wave prints, two more sets of reliefs. And the IRS reliefs, that's for irregular shapes. And I've circled four of those because your other four after loomings are from that series. So those are your five way up at the top. And everything he did afterwards, we don't see here in Fort Worth. So you've really got the beautiful beginning of the series. And so I'm going to try to show you what unfolded after that. But of course, in my case, when I got to his studio in 92, He'd already done about half of this stuff, so I had to catch up with what he'd done while also seeing things as he was creating them, the newer work. And that was pretty exciting to do. I mean, I don't know what was more exciting. So I'm going to share some of that. And I'm going to start with the ones I saw first in America. And the first one I ever saw was the one you have here, Lumings, from the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis. And there were two Lumings, and it happened, the other one's in public too. It's in the lobby of an office building in Chicago. And it's the same design, the same size, but here he's got a cast aluminum wave instead of the fabricated aluminum. It just makes all the difference. And it's painted differently too. So these are two versions of the same design, and he followed that pattern with all these metallic reliefs. So all the ones you have here, there are other versions out there, twins, brothers, half-sisters, whatever you want to call them. So the next one I heard about was down in the Baltimore Museum of Art, where I'd heard they had, on loan, you had The Whiteness of the Whale and Fadala. It happened to be the two you have here, and my picture only got part of Fadala, so here's the way they were in the Whitney. And these are both really interesting works, and they use two prominent wave shapes, and I'm going to go back here. I really like this two-way wave in Fadala, where you have the big kind of monster wave and the little seahorse wave, and they show very nicely against the people here. And then we're going to look at The Whiteness of the Whale, which is really one of the signature pieces of the whole series. And there's that same wave shape that we saw in the Sphinx and also one of the prints. It's the top part of the whale-like shape here. And I really came to love that shape because the more I looked at it, the more I could see. You've got, if you're thinking whale, you've got a tight little mouth there on a squarish head, and the eye could be there unless it's there. We're kind of Picasso-like here in terms of finding the eyes. But if you go up to the forehead, that's a white bird up there on the forehead, which happens all the time in the novel. Every time you see Moby Dick, there are birds perching on his head. And then if you come around here, there's a beautiful negative shape of the head of a bird. And if you're from Puget Sound like me, that's a seagull. We were the Everett High Seagulls. And if you're thinking seagull, well, these are the bird's wings right here in that negative shape. But if you're thinking whale, that's all those, also the shape of the whale's flukes. They're almost identical. It's crazy when you think about it. So this is an incredibly protean shape that can, it has all those things going on at once if you become aware of them. And as it moves through the series, different elements of that come to the fore. And in fact, this negative shape is also like a human head, depending on what kind of shadows and other things are around. And there's one work where it's just a head. There's no question about it. So it's a very important shape for this work, where he paints the whale of the whiteness of the whale white. He doesn't always do that, but here he gives in. He lets a little obvious connection come across. So I also saw very early your blanket, which you have here, which I love, but it was in the Dean Witter building up on the 41st floor or something in New York, and it was crowded just in a small little room, and it looked real uncomfortable there, but I really love seeing it. I think it's a very interesting piece, and I was very happy to see it breathing more openly at the Whitney, and even more here, where it's the centerpiece of your installation. And here's Stella at the Whitney opening, with the blanket. And there I think you can see how clearly the human-like element of the wave on the right, where the human figure is riding high with the heads and the arms. And the two shapes are together. There's a three-way wave, and here's the two-headed wave, except you can't see the little seahorse's head because it's behind Frank Stella, and it's also behind the whale's head in the three-way wave. So he melding, these waves are speaking to each other, the shapes, again, like characters in a way, seamlessly link together and start having relationships and creating energy of a visual kind that can sometimes have an emotional component too. So here's your installation here, and I think it's so great that you have the blanket right in the middle and the others on the side. And I'm going to just look at your fifth work here too. And this is the Grand Armada from the installation in New York at the Whitney. And this is named for the chapter One of the toughest chapters in the book, because they come across a pod of sperm whales and they try to harpoon as many as they can, because sometimes you go months without a chance. And amid all the carnage, Ishmael looks down and sees this baby whale right next to its mother. It's just been born. And it's like the ecological center, the cosmic center of the book. It's an image of fruition that's the total obverse from what all the men are doing. And I like this image because it's pretty tough in the center there, but that beautiful little whale floats up at the top. And because it's named for that chapter, the Grand Armada, I like to think of that as comparable to the little baby whale in that chapter. And there's a close-up of that shape. Now, this shape appears in the first major art historical approach to Stella's series in 89. Phil Leder wrote this major piece in Art in America, and I'd been surprised that I started reading reviews and most people didn't pay any attention to the titles. They were just treating Stella as an abstract formalist and thinking, well, those titles don't really mean much. Leder did a beautiful job analyzing the formal vocabulary of this series and the shape Stella was making and how they interrelated them and all of that. And he was kind of interested in the fact that all these works had titles from Moby Dick. Stella was about 40 works into the series by then. But as he ended up saying, it's not fruitful to think about that, because it's not obvious exactly what the relationship would be between a particular work and a title. So because it's not obvious, it's wrong to do that. But with me as a literary interpreter, what I love is there's so many different kinds of associations that you can make. It's not obvious. You have to use your imagination or see how things grow over the series. But that's what makes it interesting, as the series picks up a flow and energy comparable to that of the novel itself. Now, that's that little baby whale's head, but it's painted differently. You may have noticed if you have sharp eyes, because it's from the other version. And the one that's twice as large, and I saw this in my second trip to Japan on Naoshima, and this is 20 feet tall. And that's no longer a baby whale up there. And it's also not as separate from the rest of the body, because it's covered with the paint overpainting that links it more to the rest of the design than before. So the feeling is quite different. So now I'm going to kind of take you through the way the whole series evolved, kind of as I got to know it. And when I started methodically, I decided I wanted to write a book about the thing, so I wanted to be familiar with all the different subcategories and whatever as much as possible, but it was hard to do in a way. This is another one of the early S reliefs, like Lumines, one of the first seven images in the series, and this is the decanter, and it's here in Texas. This is at the Museum History of Fine Arts. It was outdoors. It was nice. The B series, the one after that, he started taking discs where he had that Chinese lattice and then laying one of the wave shapes over it. And this is named for the Triworks, and that's that tough image that we saw in the Shark Massacre. And this is a tough chapter. The Triworks is where the whale gets burnt by its own body, and this has some of that discomfort. With the IRS series, of which you have four here, the last three were quite deliberate on Stella's part, because he named them for the last three IRSs in 89 or so, for the chase chapters that end the novel. This is the first day of the chase. These are about 16 feet wide. They're all horizontal. They all have a lot of commotion, especially in this one on the right. This is the first day of the chase. This is the second day. And you can see here that the three-way wave and that little human figure I like so much, it's all white this time and it's riding high. That human figure is high and right over a harpoon-like object. Things are looking pretty good on the Pequod this day. And there's the head of the whale sounding to the left, if you're thinking at all like what the chapter is named for. But the third day, the last day of the chase, is total commotion. And in the novel, this is where everyone dies but Ishmael. They're all suffocated. They all drown because Ahab's taken them to their death. And this is so much commotion, you can barely make out anything individual. But there's our three-way wave, and that's the human head. You see right there the head and the arms? And it's going down. It's getting lost. and the whale-like head is going up. So it's kind of a perfect orientation for that symbol in terms of what was going on in that chapter. Now, after the IRS, he did some scrap reliefs for he started putting little pieces of things together, and this is the sperm whale's head, and it was also in Houston. I got 2-for-1 on my Houston trip, and I love this work. It was at the Meredith Long Gallery in Houston. Then he started doing what he called the sea reliefs. He just gave names to keep track of them in the studio. And this is one of the first ones, and it's named for the chapel. That's where Ishmael goes into the seaman's Bethel and sees these cenotaphs on the wall and all the people who've died going whaling, and he gets pretty scared. So Stella piles these three black waves on top of each other, which really gives you that kind of ominous, looming feeling over you. Here's another one from the same period. And here, this is the Pequod meets the Albatross, the first time they encounter another ship, and the men from the up on the mastheads try to talk to each other. And there's that three-way wave. Do you see the human head and arm up there? It's that wave that we have right here in the blanket. But now it's so overpainted by other imagery that you kind of only know it's there if you've seen it before. And this is a really interesting period. This period in the series I called overpainted understructure, because the understructure is always recognizable if you know it, but it has this other layer on top of it. And that was the small version, a very sweet one, that was in a gallery in St. Louis, in San Francisco. And then I come into Stella's studio one day, and here's the 2X version, twice as large. Same design, but totally different impression. Again, the spatial relation, and also it's painted totally differently. And here that human form does paint it black, but it does stand out very clearly at the top and recognizably. Well, my first trip to the Tyler Graphics, he was doing The Fountain, which is a 23-foot mural print that was at the Whitney, but not here. And the paper was made in Japan, Kozo paper, because there wasn't American paper strong enough to hold it. And on my second trip to Japan, I went to the factory on Shikoku where they made the paper. It was pretty exciting. But this, you can see here that he's using the kind of waves that we had in the chapel in the relief, but here it's on paper in a print. And there's the whole print itself, which was right next to the Grand Armada at the Whitney. Just an amazing body of work. It was in an edition of 8. There are 8 of these in the world. There are 60 of those wave prints. You might come across those almost anywhere. Well, here is his first sculpture. It's called The Town Hose Story, and it's in Chicago. He made it at Talix and sent it to Chicago on 3 trucks, long truckloads, and it was pretty hard to install. They had to take out all the windows in the lobby of the Metcalf Federal Building. They had to take out the high windows and float the things in on a crane, and they had to move a baby crane in to lift this stuff up because it's 23 feet high. And it was, I got to go there, or decided to go there to watch it be installed. And it's a powerful work. And it's, the Town Hose Story is a powerful chapter because it's one of those digressions where they meet another ship and they hear about a mutiny, actually. Steel Kilt does mutiny because his captain's been unfair. And the toughest thing about Moby Dick is that Starbuck, the first mate, is no Steel Kilt. We don't have a mutiny, unfortunately. And at this point, Stella, some of the metallic works here are crunched up versions of earlier things, like the lattice from the Ahab print is in here. But most of the work, it's found objects in a Connecticut graveyard, a junkyard, crushed industrial tanks, throwaway stuff from our disposable society, he's made into this very beautiful, powerful, challenging artwork. Very interesting to see. And this is the other really big sculpture in the series, the Cabin Ahab and Pip, which is named for a very apocalyptic chapter at the end of the novel, if you know it. And that's at Talix Foundry. Now they've moved to the Pollock Artworks in Newburgh. And This is a kind of smoke ring shape that we'll talk about later, that he made that whole thing on the top. But mounted on the sides are eight different unpainted reliefs like that first masthead. So you've got nine in one here. You've got nine Moby Dick chapters in this powerful piece, and it's very interesting to walk around from all angles. On my second trip to Japan, I was very interested to hear that one of the works was in Kochi, where they had a brand new museum. That's on the island of Shikoku. The work is The Pequod Meets the Rosebud. So I walk into that brand new museum, and here it is. It's the centerpiece of the whole museum. It's right in the lobby. It's the only work in the lobby. They built their whole display around this work. And this also is in that period, actually, at the on the left, that's the head of the Moby Dick whale. And there is that two-headed whale that you have in Fidala here. So it's another one where familiar shapes are used, but they're overpainted so you don't recognize them. And I think that's so much like our lives in a way. I mean, we have these primary components of our personalities, and as we grow, our lives get more complex. We add experience to it, and hopefully we can hold it all together and be richer for it. And I think there are many ways in which the waves and the treatment of things in this series parallel human life, and it's one thing that makes it interesting to see the whole series. They're fine one by one, but when you see what happens as his whole process grows, it can get pretty interesting. When I went to Germany for the first time, this work was at the Albertinum, which is a very famous museum in Dresden, and that has our Fidala wave at the top, the three-way wave is at the bottom. Again, those shapes are there if you look for them, but that's not the point. It's just a whole new configuration that's mysterious and rich and interesting. And this was happened to be in the stairwell of the gallery, and it was picking up a lot of light from the windows. I thought it was a very big, great place to have it. And the destination for that trip for me was Ulm, where the architect Richard Meyer had just built his Stadthaus in Ulm right under the famous cathedral. And the first art show for the opening of the building itself was the second series of prints that Melville did called the Moby Dick Engravings. And again, he's using things that we've seen. There's that painful whale and wave shape that was in the Sphinx and the Triworks. And here it's positioned against the lattice that was in Ahab's leg. And that lattice appears in about 10 places somewhere in the series. But this is the only place where he opens up the center of that lattice so you can see it's based on a swastika design. Everything radiates out from a swastika. Now, the original Chinese design, Stella got it in a book published in 1913, so that had nothing to do with Hitler in China, but it has everything to do in Ulm, Germany in 1993, and they put this on the cover of their catalog. This was obviously a very important thing to them. And that chapter in the novel is maybe the worst. It's a totally gratuitous killing, where Stubb and Flask kill a right whale. That's the name of the chapter title. And the reason they do is they have that big sperm whale's head on one side of the ship, and it's hard to steer straight. So you can steer better if you got something else on the other side. Plus, there's a superstition among whalers that if you've got a sperm whale head on one side and a right whale's head on the other, you'll have a prosperous voyage. So they kill this poor right whale just for those two reasons, and it's pretty interesting that he named this particular print for that, which has such a painful whale shape, plus the swastika. Well, one day I came in to New York, and he says, "Do you want to see a movie?" Well, you don't say no to Frank Stella. You never know what he's going to be doing. So he loves cigars. I don't know if you know that. I don't know if he smoked one. Maybe they don't allow it in the building here. Maybe he did anyway. I don't know. So he's making a movie of his own cigar smoke. He's blowing smoke rings into a box that has six cameras mounted on it so he can photograph the way the smoke floats and moves and holds in the air, because he was fascinated with the motion of that. And somehow that was going to have something to do with the Moby Dick series. I had no idea what. Well, it became the inspiration for his last series of prints, the Moby Dick Deckel Edges, which have a lot of colorful deckel edges in terms of that element of the construction, but we have smoke rings floating through that came from this project. This is the monkey rope where you can see a smoke ring very obviously. Here's another deckel edge, and this is the affidavit. That blue is it's an abstraction of a smoke ring. There's a more obvious ring that's still, you know, unfolding. They move beautifully, but I was really struck by that. Those were Japanese characters, and he never uses words in his work, except in the titles on the wall. So I was really interested, and I want to know, you know, what is that? Why is it? I don't read Japanese. And they're sitting there right next to the water, which looks kind of ominous. You only find out things from him if you ask the right question. He doesn't volunteer anything, but he answered this question, and it came from this incredible print by Kuniyoshi, a triptych, done exactly when Melville did Moby Dick, 1848 to 52 is how this is dated. And it's titled Musashi, Miyamoto Musashi Killing the Whale, a famous samurai story. So the legend that tells... I'm pushing the wrong button here. The legend that tells Musashi's story is up there, and that's what Stella borrowed there for his words. And then what looks like bubbles in his print is actually the crustacea on the body of this beautiful right whale. And Japanese and biologists tell me this right whale is pregnant, too. So it's a very beautiful image. So it shows another of the sources. And when I asked him the question, he dug out and had the postcard of this, you know. Early on, I'd learned that he started the series, he told the story quite often, when he had two young sons. He was kind of bored. They went out to the Coney Island Aquarium where they have beluga whales. And he said, he's looking there, and here are these whales looking through glass, and they're floating there, and they're just kind of looming over you, and he just loved their abstract shapes. And that's what made him decide to create a wave shape. And with a little bit of figurative power to it as maybe something to use in his new series. So I wanted to go get to know those whales if they're still there. So I went out to Coney Island about 93, and they had just had a new series of postcards. And here's a mother beluga with a calf who's like 2 weeks old or something. So the calf Stella didn't see. I saw the calf. But that's the mother. That's someone he saw back in 85 when he started, probably. Now, I had heard from my biology friends that whales sometimes blow water rings. And I was curious whether these whales out there ever did that. So I asked the naturalist who was there, and I couldn't believe it. They had this picture of this whale blowing a water ring. And so I asked Stella, did you ever see those whales out there blowing water rings? And, well, I don't remember seeing that or anything. So this is like art being another world, yet one to which we have a tie. And with Stella, you can't always be sure whether the tie is intentional or not. Sometimes it's accidental. Sometimes it's cosmically accidental. And I just thought it was wonderful to find this after seeing him building that whole series of deckel edges on the smoke rings. So we're near the end of the series here, and this is one of the last works. It's called School and Schoolmasters, and he's kind of clearing the decks here, as they do after they've finished the whale, and using up whatever is there. And so these are kind of used up versions of imagery that we've seen all the way through the series. And on the far right there is my three-way wave, the one I like so much. And the human head is right there. There's the head and the arms, and here's the whale-like head. But it's essentially being buried here under poured aluminum. This is probably the last time we'll see it. It's run its course. It's had a beautiful run. It's part of 13 wave shapes that have been born and fresh way at the beginning, like your looming's wave is here, and has gone through all this experience. I've got one more image to show you. This is the ship. And as he got into architecture, as he got into sculpture, he also got interested in architecture. And this is the first building he designed, and it was for a museum in Groningen, Germany, which happens to be the German town that Herman Melville's ancestors came from. And they had commissioned this work far enough for him to come along with this design, but then the financing fell through or something, it didn't get built. And then it was thought about for a desert museum in Israel, but that didn't happen. So this is not yet realized, but hopefully someday it will be an actual museum, and if so, I hope they have a Moby Dick show in it. But this kind of corresponds to Melville in the cetology chapter, where he gets a little philosophical and says, this whole book is but a draft of a draft. And he says, the great erections are only created for posterity to complete. So here's one that's there for posterity to complete. And the design of the ribs of the building are from those early lattices. In fact, one of the lattices that I saw in the Solway Gallery. So these images live on. So I want to conclude by just saying a few words about the challenge of writing this book. I knew pretty much after Japan that I wanted to write a book about this because it's very interesting. And then also the art critics weren't saying anything about Melville or Moby Dick. So I was finding something about every work that related in one way or the other to the chapter. So the obvious way for me seemed to be to start with Loomings, chapter one. Well, actually, he does etymology and extracts before Loomings, too. And just show how every work relates in an interesting way. Just make float through a cruise through the whole series, showing how it really does relate to the novel. And I was really enjoying that because it's a challenge to kind of translate that semi-abstract stuff into something that relates in a convey it in a clear way. And I was enjoying it, but when I got to about the whiteness of the whale, I got the worst writer's block I'd ever had because it just felt wrong. I mean, I could do it, but that's not what Stella did. Stella wasn't taking one chapter after another and trying to match it up in a linear way. He was jumping all over the damn place, and he was using the inspiration from the novel to find out where he wanted to go as an artist. It was the momentum, the ambition, the rhythm, the braveness of Melville that he was trying to do. So I realized the way I wanted to write the book was the way he had written it, or the way he created his series. So after some introductory chapters, you've got Loomings, and then the next series of prints, and then the different subsections as they came along. And writing that was a lot more fun because it was trying to really get into his creative process by which over a 12-year period, he created what I feel is an equivalent to Moby Dick. It's an incredible conceptual and artistic creation. I'm going to leave you with one image. Go back to our sperm whale's head. In Moby Dick, Ishmael's trying to articulate what's so incredibly impressive about the head of this particular whale. And he decides he can't fully explain it. And he doesn't want to explain it, really. He wants us to get there. So he says, I but put that brow before you. Read it if you can. And I think that's pure Melville of Moby Dick. It's not an easy book to read. I know some of you have been reading through it this summer. It's a beautiful challenge. And that's Stella, too. He's not going to tell us what it means. He's not going to have little sidebars or footnotes saying, showing how cute he is and how great it is. He's going to make something that lives in itself that invites us to lift up to where he is and expand ourselves to figure out and feel what he's doing. So I feel very honored to have been here to see your show, to see your incredible museum, and to be with this Tuesday night audience. So thank you very much. I'd be happy to have questions if anyone does.
I'll start.
Okay.
Sometimes that gets it going. I wonder if you could just speak a little bit on the subject of space, mm-hmm. as it relates to Stella, and as it relates to the book Moby Dick?
The concept of space, it's a pretty good question. I mean,
that might be another lecture.
Well, you know, first, you know, with Stella, I think of working space and those lectures he gave where he wants to bring space alive. I mean, and it's interesting. He wants, in that amazing meditation on Renaissance and Baroque art, he's looking at The Slaying of Marsyas, a really difficult work by Titian. And it's a hard image to look at because it's so painful. But he feels that there's that what's happening in the space of the artwork, there has to be an emotional transaction somehow between it and the viewer. So the space, I guess, I think in a way, maybe it's the space between, in that picture of the Whitney Museum, between the people doing the marathon and the work up there. It's the transaction that takes place between the natural world and humans who perceive it, between an artwork and viewers, between a novelist and readers, between that another world and something to which we feel a tie. And I think that Stella and Melville both work in a huge space, in a cosmic space. They want to get as much as possible happening, to relate to as much as our human consciousness can relate to. So there's a global element, obviously, about Moby Dick, there's the physical exploration going almost all the way around the world. And then you've got the cultural space of all the people on the crew. And then you've got the space the sailors are cramped into in the ship, and then you've got the space where all the killing takes place. You've got all these different kinds of space that are happening, and I think Stella, in his use of the space of figure and ground, whether he's getting a little representational and figurative here or in his more purely abstract, there's a relationship between figure and ground that creates tension, and that creates meaning potentially. But then he adds to the space, interpretive space, with titles. And the Moby Dick is certainly a striking example. But his titles, his whole career have been fascinating. Today I came here in a cab, and the guy says he's from Iran. And I said, well, where in Iran? Basra. Or no, he said southern Iran. And I said, I'm sorry, it's Iraq that he's from. And he says southern Iraq. And I said, are you from Basra? And he said, he couldn't believe that I knew Basra. Well, the way I came to know Basra before our war and everything was that Stella's protractor series is named for Middle Eastern cities, and one of them is Basra Gate. A lot of his names, because he loved the, it's like two protractors together in those circular shapes that Middle Eastern cities had. That all of his titles have an intellectual or historical or emotional meaning they don't duplicate, but they add to what is actually going on, which I think is so much like Melville, too, where you've got the plot of the story, but you've got all these other kinds of meaning going on. So I guess I'd just say all sorts of intersecting spaces of multiple kinds are one of the things they most have in common, I think. Yes?
Let me follow a space question with a time question.
Okay.
There is a time, obviously, in the novel,
right,
occupies a certain period of time. Is there time in Stella's representations?
Well, I guess, you know, to start with, you have the time of the making that it took Melville a year and a half, took Stella 12 years. I don't know, it's interesting. That's a really interesting question about. Obviously, in the making of the series, there's a time, but I think there's an element of time in a way within his abstract works as well, because, you know, you think of painting as static and music as, you know, narrative, and you know, who Schiller or someone made that big distinction. It's been important to theoreticians. And in some ways that's true. The paintings, the whiteness of the whale that we have here does not move. It's just sitting there. The blanket sculpture does not move. It's a static object. Yet, I think like maybe a Chopin etude, let's take that, which takes 3.5 minutes sometimes. And it takes time to listen to that because it's a narrative. And you can't hear it without time. You can look at one of these without taking time, but to see it, you have to take time because there's so many different things to see. First of all, there's always a figure and ground thing, which are pretty complex and fascinating in all five works here, I would say. But there's also kind of circular, like, you know, the way I read the head of the whiteness of the whale, that head that has the bird and the negative space and the triple meaning negative space. I mean, I think that his physically static constructions take time to really imbibe, to take in, and certainly time to work out the meaning of. So I think that's, he may be more so than a lot of other artists, I think, because there's so much consciousness and intuition built in there. I mean, I do wonder about him and Melville, both how they could achieve such great, powerful, complex works, some of whose elements they obviously planned out very carefully, like, you know, when he's doing the 3 days of the chase, he knows what he's doing there. But so much of it else has to be by intuition. They couldn't have stopped and figured it out, you know. And he said, I could never get him to talk about what the whole series means. And he said, I think I believe it. He said, I can just do one thing at a time. I can never stop back and you know, get out and see what it all means. So there's the time of the pure creation without even looking to the end game somehow. I mean, and I think it's so fascinating the way this thing grew over 12 years. He started out just a painter and a printmaker, and he ends up complicating that so much, and here he really moves into a lot of figurative and narrative implication in these works, which he had rejected doing before. And then he's moving into sculpture and toward architecture. It's really kind of an amazing sort of growth. And I think, you know, maybe if you look at the experience of these individual shapes, like that Moby Dick whale shape, there's time in the life of that shape through the course of the series. I think that's a very interesting kind of time, how that works out. So those are some ways of... You've given me two big questions here. Hope there's not a third one as tough as those. Yes?
Thank you very much. Now I see the exhibition much better.
Oh, thank you.
Because it looks like you were in literature and went into art. Did any other artist inspire you?
Yes, I got started with art. Actually, we have a student here. Where's Barbara? Barbara was my student in Northern Kentucky, and she took my music and literature course when I was doing the Austin and Mozart stuff. And she said, can you do a course involving painting? And I'd never taught painting or thought about it that way, but she was such a great student. I said, well, if you'll help me research some of the stuff, I'll teach one. So we spent a year together basically getting ready for this course. And the one thing I had that I knew I could build on was Melville and Turner, because I had seen a relation between Turner's paintings and Moby Dick that I wanted to follow up on. So that, and there's a curious story there that is probably worth telling. I go to Columbia and get a PhD in literature, and there are only 6 jobs in the country, and I only get one interview, and that's at a brand new school in Northern Kentucky that I'd never heard of. And the graduate advisor at Columbia says, don't go there, Columbia people should do better than that, but no one's getting jobs anywhere, so I took it. So I get there, and it's a commuter school, and I start out, I teach 15 novels the first class. I mean, ridiculous, in a semester, including Moby Dick and Middlemarch was another, I mean, it was nuts. So I'd only given 2 weeks for Moby Dick. Now I take 3.5. I have a friend who takes the whole 15 weeks, which I'd love to do sometime, but if I'm doing the art in it, I want to do a lot of other stuff too. So, right away, these students are pissed. But they had some good reasons that way, and then they're in trouble with the novel. So the Spouterin painting, you know, he goes in the door and he sees this painting, and the kid says, he spends 3 paragraphs talking about it, and he still doesn't know what it means. Why does he bother, you know? And of course, that's important to study for the whole book, which we've got to explain later. But the best way I could answer that was to take some Turner paintings in the next day, because the aesthetic is so similar, and I had seen the whale ship at the Met in New York. And that helped to explain the kind of painting that it's really very much like a Turner, and really only Turner was painting works like that, where the water's a nameless yeast and the whale's a black portentous something in the midst of the picture. It's very advanced. And so that interested me, and then Turner has all these great paintings, the Lee Shore, which Melville writes about in chapter 23 so well, with a very similar aesthetic. So it was something I really wanted to do. So Barbara and I had a great time there. And now I teach a course I started teaching Moby Dick and the arts in 95. And I do that with Emily Dickinson now too. So there are a lot of artists I love who've done both. My book on Jake Hagee's Moby Dick, Hagee's opera premiered in Dallas in 2010, and it's coming here again in November. It's a really brilliant work. So one of the great things about Moby Dick is it has inspired so many different artistic responses by different artists. And Elizabeth Schultz wrote a great book called Unpainted to the Last, which she published in 1999, showing how many great artists, including a lot of the abstract expressionists, had done a couple works on Moby Dick. Pollock did, and Motherwell, and Kelly. All these people had a couple Moby Dicks. Sam Francis had several really great ones. So there's a tradition there, but it's even getting stronger right now. And that's happening with Dickinson and visual poetry, too. So I think that I found in teaching, actually, I started giving my students the option of doing an artwork instead of a research paper, because Fred North in 1994 requested that. He says, I'm an art major, and Moby Dick's given me a lot of great ideas. Could I do a painting instead of one of those research paper things? And he was an older student, 44 years old, ran the union floor at the Ford transmission plant. He was the kind of guy, you trusted, let's go with Fred and see what happens. And he did 2 beautiful paintings, which I have in my house right now. So I've been giving that, one of them I have. So I've been giving that option to my students. And it's interesting, lately, like, these are not art majors. There may be 1 or 2 art majors out of 15. They're mostly honors and English students. And these days, 13 out of 15 will do the artwork instead of the research paper. People are interested in crossing the fields. And instead of, if you write a research paper, I love those. That's what I do. I mean, I do secondary work. I don't create art myself. I write about art, and I love doing that. But if a student writes a research paper, well, first they learn what everyone else has said. They know the footnotes and all that, and then maybe they'll develop a real idea of their own in the process. Hopefully they will. But if you're reading a novel and you get the impulse to make an artwork in response to it, it's something inside you that has sparked that. And they do great work, even if they haven't had training. So this is one reason I haven't retired yet. As a teacher, I'm 72. But the last 2 weeks of the course, either the Dickinson in Arts or the Moby Dick in the Arts, when the students present their final projects, is fascinating. And you can't predict what's going to happen. There's no predicting. That's what's so exciting. You can predict research papers after a while, for the most part. So I just feel so grateful to Barbara for pulling me into doing something with art in the classroom, and that's really led to all of this, and it was because I gave the talk about Turner that I found out who Stella was, and it's been really interesting to just follow one thing after another. And I guess that is kind of Moby Dick-like. I mean, one thing that's really hard for a student's first time is the way he'll just shift gears from one chapter to another and all that. But God, it's so great when you reread the book and just see the interrelations among all these seemingly unlike things. And I think Stella has that power too. And in this work, running through his whole career, the imagery changes, but the mental power of working space, as he would say, of using shapes in relation to each other, in relation to a ground, and in relation to an imagined viewer, stays the same. It's really been a thrill to see this show here and also in New York.
That's a great big hand. Okay.